Hi, I'm Dr. Stan Steindl. Welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt. If you've been here before, welcome back. If this is your first time, then thanks so much for joining me and let me know what you think. Today I'll be speaking with Dr. Steve Hickman, who's a clinical psychologist currently residing in Oregon, USA. He's a certified mindful self-compassion teacher and trainer and was the former executive director of the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion. He's also the author of Self-Compassion for Dummies, which I highly recommend. It offers a practical, good-humored approach to cultivating self-compassion. It was a great conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. And so I bring you Dr. Steve Hickman. Well, Steve Hickman, welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Wonderful to see you again. The first time, actually, that I was aware of you was years ago. There was a video recording where you introduced Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he gave his Coming to His Senses talk. I think it was his new book at the time, and he was doing a kind of a book tour type thing, maybe, or something like that. And you introduced him. Do you remember that one?
I do, and it says a little bit about me and my background. I can say a little more about it because that was at the University of California at San Diego, where I founded the Center for Mindfulness. But my first encounter with John was as a trainee. I was working at UCSD, and our boss insisted we all go to this grand rounds with this guy, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who I'd never heard of, didn't know who he was. And I went because my boss said to, and here he was talking about mindfulness and MBSR. And I sort of sat in the back and I thought, oh, this is cute, but I'm never going to, you know, do this meditation yoga stuff, and sort of poo-pooed it. And one thing led to another. I ultimately started working with people with chronic pain and somehow circled back to mindfulness as being something that would be helpful to them. And went on to get training to be an MBSR teacher. One thing led to another, and we were building up our center, and I stayed connected to John off and on. And so when he went on this book tour, I had this great opportunity to introduce him in the same auditorium where I first heard of him. And he remembers it because that was one of the first times he was video recorded and put online on YouTube. We had arranged to record it kind of in the early days of doing things like that. So now I mostly, when I've gone back to look at that video a couple of times, what I hear is that my people say, oh, he's great talk with Jon Kabat-Zinn. The guy that introduces him goes on forever. Fast forward to like 4 minutes and 53 seconds when he gets off the stage. So it keeps me humble that way.
Oh, really? I hadn't really sort of felt that myself. I mean, I loved that talk though from John, and went back to that many times, you know, back, especially, I think it was it 2008 or something, I think was perhaps around when.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Sure. Because it wasn't long after that I didn't ever do MBSR training, but I did mindful based relapse prevention training and became MBRP teacher, so that was, which I think was run by you as well, actually. I'm just suddenly realizing. That was at Joshua Tree with Alan Marlett and Sarah Bowen and Neha. Others. Yeah. So that must have been around that time that I went and did that, because then the next time after that, I guess, was the MSC retreat in Joshua Tree that you also convened, and that was with Chris and Kristen and Christy. I was talking to Chris Germer about that just recently, just reminiscing. Actually, I wanted to show you, you remember these?
The self-compassionate bracelets.
Self-compassionate bracelet from that from that very, very retreat. I've kept it. Sort of carefully kept it all these years, take it whenever I move houses or whatever. So it was sort of a game changer for me, that particular retreat.
A self-compassion practice, I think, often is, even for people who are, you know, familiar with contemplative practice or other sorts of approaches compassion-based approaches. There's something switches there. It's what I used to say when I first started teaching mindful self-compassion. The first couple rounds that I taught with my friend Michelle Becker, who was the one who kind of brought me into this mindful self-compassion world. I had been teaching MBSR for a long time, but the people that came to those classes we taught at UCSD, a lot of them were people who had taken MBSR from me, and they seem to have gotten something. You never quite know what people are actually kind of personally getting, but they came to MSC and something different, qualitatively different, happened for them. The way I've described it is they kind of bloomed or melted or something. They seemed more engaged, and they were engaged in the previous class, but they seemed to laugh more, cry more, connect more with the material. There was something going on there, and I think my story about it, they shared some things, but my story was that when they learned mindfulness practice, they learned how to stay present to all of their experience. And for these folks in particular, their experience included a lot of like harsh inner criticism and shame and things like that. And to a certain extent, they didn't know what to do with it. They sort of white knuckled it in. They were okay, I need to stay present with this. But they felt like there was something, I don't want to say missing, but they needed something. And self-compassion seemed to be the thing. It was like, oh, there's a way to actually meet myself in the midst of being aware of this inner critic or this shame coming up or whatever it was, any kind of difficulty. So there was really a qualitative shift for them, not taking away anything from the mindfulness practice, because I think it prepared them. They gave them some valuable resources for how to just show up and be present. But like I said, something melted for them that really kind of made a difference.
Yeah, no, that was definitely my experience, I think. The mindfulness really created awareness and acceptance and being able to be present in the moment. And then mindful self-compassion then meant turning towards suffering, basically. And so it was a much more sort of emotionally, viscerally felt experience, and definitely had the tears and the laughter in kind of equal measure almost. And yeah, I like how you said sort of maybe something melted or something. Was that what you said? And for me it was almost like, lovingly cracked open almost. I think it sort of it kept getting through some sort of kind of armor and then into that. I've always been told, but even growing up, that I was hard on the outside but soft on the inside. So I think self-compassion was the way that, that was able to be worked with, finally.
One of the things that I've come to say sometimes with folks is sometimes people come in really motivated to want to be more self-compassionate, almost driven with a kind of perfectionistic quality, which is really not that conducive to self-compassion. But I always say it's more about melting than mining. That there it's a it it real really for most people needs to be a sort of slow, steady, continuous process, as opposed to drilling down and getting right to the heart of it, because it is, like you said, it's essentially, I even joke about it, if the whole program Mindful Self-Compassion is about opening to pain and suffering, but we can't call it that because no one would sign up for the class.
No.
So good marketing move not to call it that,
Yes.
but it kind of is what it is. But it's a slow, steady process, because we're not inclined to turn towards struggle and suffering and pain and those kinds of things. But it can be, like I said, a gradual process of, being willing to be a slow learner is one of the things that we say sometimes to remind people to take it easy, one step at a time.
Yeah, great.
You're
No.
unlearning, maybe a lifetime of habits of avoiding, of, being ruled by an inner critic or, overcome by shame. So, it's okay to take a little time with it.
Yeah, thank you. No, I really appreciate just hearing a little bit of your journey into it, the sort of the mindfulness stuff and the there was a little bit of an awakening there for you in a sense, with the MBSR and so on. And then the mindful self-compassion was the next bit. So how would you, sort of define self-compassion, but maybe the MSC kind of version, but maybe also just the Steve Hickman, sort of version? What is self-compassion, I guess?
Yeah, it's hard for me to separate too much from the program itself because it was my introduction to self-compassion. I do have to admit that when I started teaching mindful self-compassion, I was teaching, as I said, MBSR, and I was a skeptic. When Michelle came back from a training she did with Chris Germer and Kristen Neff, they had discussed whether she would like to be the first teacher of MSC aside from the two of them, and she was flattered, and they said, well, we really like to have co-teachers, and it would be great if you could find someone who was an MBSR teacher to be a co-teacher. And so one thing led to another, and she asked me if I would co-teach it with her. She also knew at the time that I have a pathological inability to say no to things, so I said yes. But I was a skeptic. I mean, there was a part of me that said, isn't this already in mindfulness? Isn't compassion a part of mindfulness? And we had long discussions with Chris and Kristen about compassion versus mindfulness, or self-compassion and mindfulness. And are they different things? Are they two sides of the same coin? At some point, I don't think it really matters that much. I think they're intertwined. You can't have one without the other, really. And in the end, I've always liked the definition of self-compassion is just learning to treat yourself the way you would treat a good friend when you struggle and suffer, fall short, fail, etc. I mean, what I love about that too is that it's a skill you already have. You just maybe haven't given it a U-turn to kind of include yourself in that circle. Like, most people know how to be kind to others when they're having a hard time, and they just can't seem to pull it off for themselves. But that's all it is. I mean, it's no rarefied extra skill that's different from compassion, directed outward. So it's like you've got it, you just need to kind of direct it a different way.
You've said before that the sort of the simple but profound question of self-compassion is, what do I need right now
Right.
in this moment? Can you unpack that idea a little bit?
Yeah, I think so if we kind of go with the idea that, so compassion, there's a few definitions floating around about there, but essentially it's like a deep awareness of suffering coupled with the desire to relieve suffering. And there's spins on that, but that's for me, that's kind of the heart of it. So with self-compassion, it's the deep awareness of your own suffering and the wish to relieve it, or the practice of relieving it, or, well, the wish. So in order to kind of go about formulating a way to relieve that suffering, we need to know that we are actually suffering. We need to know what it is we need in a moment. And we're all really good at putting aside our needs quite often and tending to the needs of other people, which obviously there's nothing wrong with that. But we don't often stop to kind of consider. We can think, oh, my friend just, her partner just died and she's grieving. We sort of innately kind of know what she might need. And we may fumble with how we actually provide it, but essentially we provide comfort, support, encouragement, love, these kinds of things. We can't change the situation, so we know what that person needs. But quite often when we're suffering, we're so busy feeling isolated from other people, uniquely bad in some way, beating ourselves up, that we don't actually stop to say, what is it I need right now? So it's a simple thing, but it's not easy to practice sometimes for us in a moment of difficulty. Rather than pushing through it, ignoring it, pushing it away, resisting it in some way, we don't really know to ask, wow, just what do I need right now? And that doesn't mean anything huge. It might just mean like, wow, I could just put my hand on my heart and feel my own kind touch, or take a breath, or to say no, to take action of some sort. So it's really just, I mean, this is where the mindfulness comes in, because it gives us that capacity to notice what's happening and catch ourselves in that moment long enough to ask that question, what do I need? Sort of like I used to say about mindfulness, in a moment of struggle or difficulty, could you ask yourself, where are my feet? Because it's that dropping right into the moment. So it's kind of the self-compassion version of that question, of really just, tuning in and asking yourself, what do I need right now? Do I need comfort? Do I need encouragement? Do I need, a kick in the butt for myself? Sometimes that's the thing.
Yes, it's so interesting, isn't it, really, that self-compassion is just how you might treat a friend who is struggling, and is there a way to treat oneself in that same way, and sort of ask that simple yet profound question, what do I also need right now? And in some ways, that's it. It almost feels like kind of commonsensical. And yet there are misconceptions quite often, aren't there? There are sort of what would you say are some of the misconceptions there, or the things that you've noticed or faced from people?
We ask people that question in the MSC program, and inevitably there's a constellation of about six or eight misconceptions that people have. And no matter what group you ask, and I've taught MSC all over the world, cultural differences aside, I mean, and no real cultural differences in the answers to that. What are the things people are concerned about? Most often, I think you can kind of include a bunch of them under the misconception that somehow self-compassion is like soft or weak or stereotypically feminine. So we do talk about self-compassion having both a fierce and a tender side. The tender side is the one most people think of when we talk about compassion or self-compassion, the comforting, soothing, nurturing part of self-compassion. But there is this active side as well, of the about protecting ourselves, providing for what we need, motivating ourselves, et cetera. So people will say things like, well, self-compassion just sounds like you're giving yourself whatever you want, self-indulgence, basically. It's like, oh, like I need to work out, but that quart of ice cream looks pretty good, so I'm going to eat that instead. And that's an act of self-compassion. Or, various other things. I'll just end up on the couch, watching Netflix all day if I practice self-compassion. And there's pretty good, a lot of good research that suggests that's not actually the case, right? That we actually, that compassion, self-compassion is about acting in your own best interests, not necessarily what's pleasurable, but what's in your best interest. And I love to use the example of our colleague Anna Friis in New Zealand, who worked studied working with diabetes patients, where basically the study was that half of the group got essentially treatment as usual as diabetes patients, and half had treatment as usual plus the mindful self-compassion program. And those who were in the experimental condition that got MSC improved in terms of mood, quality of life, depression, anxiety, things like that. But their HbA1c levels also improved relative to the control group. So there's nothing magic about practicing self-compassion that lowers your blood sugar, but people took better care of themselves. They presumably exercised more and ate better, et cetera. So that's the harder path, is to do that stuff. So it's not that self-indulgent thing. The people who got self-compassion training actually did the tough stuff they needed to do to take care of themselves. So that's one. I mean, there's plenty of people that think it might be sort of narcissistic, but actually that's not true. The research really suggests that people are much more, people around the person who's self-compassion tend to find that person to be more sympathetic and more understanding. And then often the big one, especially for guys, is that we fear we're going to lose our motivation, that somehow, like, we've always survived or thrived with the stick over the carrot, like the beatings will continue until morale improves, kind of a thing. Like, and then what if I start practicing self-compassion, I'll stop trying. I won't achieve the things that I want to achieve. But again, what we understand is that that's not actually the case. That actually, people who are self-compassionate will have equally high standards for themselves, and will try just as hard as the person who beat themselves up to achieve. But they will. People who are self-compassionate will tend to persist longer and try harder, mainly because they can tolerate the inevitable failures that people face. Sometimes you're going to fall short. Sometimes you're going to have a failure. And if you beat yourself up every time, berate yourself like the worst athletic coach you can imagine, at some point you don't want to try anymore. You're afraid to try because you're going to suffer, these, berating, self-critical words and actions. So really, people become stronger or more resilient if they're practicing self-compassion, so that they're able to try harder, et cetera. So those are a couple of the big ones, I think, that and virtually every common misconception, there's great research to the contrary.
Yes.
So
Yeah, no, I was noticing that as you were speaking, that actually there's a lot of research now that is supporting the broad effectiveness of self-compassion. I was reminded from you there of one of Kristen Neff's videos where she talks about, unlike self-criticism or unlike self-esteem even, self-compassion is there to kind of catch you when you fall, or when something does go wrong, or there's disappointments or failures. Self-compassion is there to sort of kind of help you to persist and keep going, and that sort of thing.
It's a, it's a kind of form of psychological flexibility, just to kind of tap into some of what the work that people do with acceptance and commitment therapy, where the heart of their change theory is essentially psychological flexibility, the ability to bend but not break, to bounce back, resilience. It's all in that same category, and it's always there. It's unconditional. It's not conditional upon performance. One thing that came to mind too that I was going to say earlier is that when people first start to try to practice self-compassion, and they ask themselves, "What do I need?" and they have trouble answering that question, or they don't know what they even need to hear. Like, we often help people to jumpstart that by doing exactly what you suggested, which is think about what you would say to a dear friend in that situation that you're in. Because often those words flow. If you picture your best friend having just failed a big test or had some sort of misfortune, you just kind of know what to say. So that's a way of jumpstarting it, is to ask yourself, well, okay, I'm struggling with this. What would I say to a friend who was struggling with this? Oh, yeah, naturally kind of flows.
Yes.
So it's in there.
It is a tough question, isn't it, to answer that one? Really, it takes a lot of presence of mind and sort of wisdom, I guess, to sort of really work out what that might even be. The thing that I really appreciated from the Mindful Self-Compassion program was also just the use of certain phrases. Here's some we prepared earlier, almost. Here are some phrases that you can start with, and even those loving kindness phrases and things like that just is a nice sort of an in as well, I think, to get started.
I think one of the most brilliant things about the MSC program, I'm sure Chris would frame it differently because he's modest, but he really came up with, I believe that was him, although I'm sure Kristen had her voice in it. But we have this practice where you craft your own self-compassion, loving kindness phrases. So we're most people who are somewhat familiar with contemplative practice know of loving kindness, know some set of phrases that they can offer to themselves, to a loved one, to a neutral person, to a difficult person, et cetera, et cetera. I don't mean to take away from them, but they're generic phrases that would work for all beings, right? But when you decide you're going to practice loving kindness for yourself, which is one of the core practices, you get this unique opportunity to take a little time and reflect on, like, what do I really need, or what do I need to hear? And, what is it that would, fill my heart with joy to hear it every day whispered into my ear? And come up with a set of phrases like that that you repeat, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, whatever they might be, but they're customized just for you because you don't have to, they don't have to apply to everybody.
Yes.
And that's a practice that can be really powerful for people to practice that over and over, offering yourself exactly what you need in a loving, supportive way.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's I really appreciated that practice as well. You mentioned men a moment ago, and I suppose I've been particularly curious about self-compassion for men, I guess, and there are various inhibitors there too, I suppose. And actually I've just noticed that men just are less often turn up, I suppose, to self-compassion related research for one thing. But also obviously for self-compassion practice or interventions or retreats. So what would you say about self-compassion for men?
Yeah, it's a interesting topic to me for a lot of reasons, largely because of what I was observing, which is exactly what you just said. If we have in any given MSE course 10% men, that's like an embarrassment of riches to have, 2 out of 20 or something like that. And it's been a curiosity, and myself and a number of colleagues have had all kinds of meetings and conversations about why is that? How could we reverse that trend? Even our female colleagues are, they want to know how can we get more men in? I think it's because they see a lot of men around them they know could use the practice. And I think a lot of it boils down to exactly what you brought up earlier, these misgivings. So guys hear self-compassion or mindful self-compassion, and it sounds soft and squishy and feminine and all the rest. So it kind of runs up against the way in which a lot of men have been raised, and all of those terrible messages that many of us got growing up about, not having emotions, big boys don't cry, don't be a sissy or various other things like this idea that somehow if you have emotions, they're a sign of weakness. Hopefully we're slowly but surely turning the tide on that ridiculousness. There's a little flurry of backlash to that in the world these days where some people who have a big influence, men, are pushing for, I guess this is more of the conservative values or whatever, like we need to go back to being more masculine. Just, the stereotyped thing, like this is the problem with men today. They're too sensitive, they're being too whatever. That's a whole sidelight that I hope will pass, but it's not helpful. I mean, sort of being getting the message that it's not okay to have emotions, or if you have emotions, you're weak, and somehow just sets up a lot of bad stuff. I mean, when you look at what we have, this horrible thing that we have uniquely here in the US of these shootings, mass shootings, they're almost always men. And I like to say that, like, each of those is really the manifestation of some man who didn't know how to deal with his own emotions. This was the only way he knew how to do that. It's a terribly destructive, horrendous, violent, awful thing. But if you kind of trace it back, somehow he was feeling some degree of suffering and didn't know what to do with it. You're not going to take somebody like that and teach them mindful self-compassion. But the point being, a lot of bad behavior arises from this inability to manage your own emotions, whether you're male, female, it doesn't really matter. But at least women have been lucky enough traditionally to have emotions, to not have them invalidated, just speaking very generally. And men haven't had that. And if not, if anything else, you're supposed to pretend that you don't have them or that you're have this tough exterior like you talked about. So it's a big hurdle to get over. And we at one point we had a we had actually tried to set up a mindful self-compassion intensive like the one you attended just for men with my colleague Daniel Ellenberg and Chris Germer and myself. We couldn't get people to sign up, you know. The idea of going off someplace for 5 days, you know, cooped up in a sitting in a circle, heaven forbid you should sit in a circle and actually make eye contact with other humans. That was just it was just a bridge too far for guys. We had a handful of people sign up and we canceled. What we did finally were able to do that Daniel Ellenberg and I did was to run a few short workshops, like weekend workshops or 2 day things. We called it Ultimate Courage because that sort of like camouflaged a little bit of the, it sounded tougher or whatever. And it was, there were beautiful experiences for the guys who came, I thought, and I think they did as well, to kind of get through that mask and to find out that, you know, that there's common humanity, you know, one of the factors of self-compassion that, you know, a bunch of guys in the room talking about each of them feeling bad, having been bullied or having bullied other people when they were younger, and just sharing the human experience of being a boy or a man really was pretty powerful. And it sort of kindled hope for me that we could do more of that kind of work. And I don't know what the secret is. You know, when we had these workshops, all of our female colleagues who were MSC teachers want to know what was going on in there. You know, were we, you know, lighting fires or running around naked or what, you know, what was going on? And it's like there's nothing terribly. I think having a group full of men felt safe, that you could talk about something that the other guys would understand and a woman may or may not understand, or at least that's people's ideas. But some. I always go back to one particular situation as kind of, it's just kind of still kind of gives me tingles. We had a guy, we have this exercise that you're familiar with on working with the inner critic and recognizing that your inner critical voice is actually trying to take care of you, trying to keep you safe, but it's just doing it in a really terrible way. So we were doing this exercise and he just really got quite emotional during the exercise and was crying quite a bit. And we checked in with him afterwards. And, you know, we said, what was going on? He said, I always hated my father. He was so hard on me all my life. When I hear the inner critic, it's his voice telling me I'm no good. I won't amount to anything, et cetera, et cetera. It's like I've had years of therapy and everything. And it and he said, and it's just always been there. And he said, when I looked to see where was he coming from, where was that criticism coming from? How was there any way in which he was trying to look out for me? I realized that he had no role models for how to be a father. He was a single father, and he was scared to death. And that's where all of this came from. It was like suddenly like a switch was flipped. And it was like it just changed the nature of the whole thing because he could realize, oh, it was abusive, it was painful, but it was coming from a place of this guy just not knowing what to do and of being afraid he was going to do the wrong thing. And for him to have make that shift was just amazing, especially with years of therapy leading up to that that didn't seem to move any of that. But it did take, you know, a willingness to turn towards difficulty, turns towards an inner critic and stuff. So anyway, now I'm kind of
No,
rambled on.
there's a lot of suffering in the world, but some of those who are suffering are definitely men, and they the difficulty there is that the suffering often turns into very problematic behavior in relationships
Exactly.
and out and about and in the community and so on. But it really often connects back to just sort of threat system activation, you know, the whether you know sort of
Right.
fear and anger and shame is sort of in the mix, and yet they perpetuate this self-critical style, which they learned early perhaps, and they just keep going in that difficult direction. But then up come, I guess as Paul Gilbert would say, up come the fears, blocks, and resistances. The fears of, what if I get lax or lazy? The blocks, I don't really know what I should even say to myself if I'm being self-compassionate. Or the resistances, it's dog eat dog out there. I need to be tough or whatever. I notice I've always, I don't know really why, but I've tended to prefer to just stick with the words compassion and self-compassion, even with men, and working with the misconceptions and seeing if we can kind of shift there. But you use that title, Ultimate Courage, and sort of as a, it's almost trying to think, how do we market it in a way, isn't it? I suppose is one of the possibilities. What are your
Yeah,
thoughts?
it was funny because what happens every time we've done that is that somewhere midway through the workshop, the guys look at us and like say, like, really, like, ultimate courage, like, basically, like, we knew what you were up to all along.
Right.
So it was we were sort of busted, so to speak. And what we were trying to do was to see, was there anything that would just a hook that would just catch guys long enough to pay attention, because it does take a lot of courage to do what we're talking about. Turning
Yes.
towards suffering is not a simple thing, and we don't mean to kind of imply that. We've never been totally satisfied with that, and I don't think we've kind of stuck with it. But I had an experience a few years ago, actually, right up the coast from where I live here in Oregon. I did a 2-day MSC workshop for U.S. Coast Guard personnel. So that's mostly young, muscly, tattooed guys that want to be heroes. I mean it in the most loving way. They love that job because it's largely, rescuing people and, correcting people who've done stupid things on the water, essentially, and gone places they shouldn't go, et cetera. And so it was mostly men. There was a few women there, but there was this guy who was really into this, like, could really see the value of being kind to himself, kind of creating a safe inner space for his own emotions. He said, "But I'm really struggling. Like, how does this work? How does this self-compassion work if I'm like dangling out of a helicopter to pluck somebody out of the ocean before they drown? Like, that's a moment of like, that's not soft. That's not, a safe, it's not, I'm not safe. It's unsafe." And we kind of wrestled with it a little bit, and we kind of came to this idea of a brave inner space that is both a safe and a brave inner space. And for him, he was able to kind of get his heart around that idea that this actually is, in line with the resilience and the strength part of self-compassion, that you can, if you're in touch with what's going on, you can have that brave inner space that allows you to do what needs to be done. It's not shutting off your emotions and, closing off to that and just being a robot to pluck that person out. It's actually accessing all of the available resources you have as a human, which include emotions. I think that's one of the pieces that I haven't talked about it a lot, but emotions are, we're wired to have them for a purpose, right? We're evolutionarily, we have them to alert us to danger, to do all the things that that we need to do as humans. And if we're cutting ourselves off from those emotions, we're cutting ourselves off from valuable data that is there for us. Like, cops are a great example. I have a couple of police officers in my family, and I've done a lot of work around police officers. And it's, that's a tough job that has a lot of emotion to it. And again, you can't do that as a robot. You have to, your emotions are there to tell you stuff, instinct to be situationally aware, to notice when your spidey sense tells you something's up. That's all real stuff. And so closing off to it is like, again, like closing you off to valuable resources that you have. So one would hope that people in general, and men specifically, would recognize that practicing self-compassion allows you then to to sort of unleash a kind of superpower that we all have, but maybe we aren't actually really accessing in a way that would help us. So there's that. I don't think I've ever said that out loud. So hopefully it makes some sense.
Yeah, no, that makes real sense. I mean, strength and courage are often the key when it comes to self-compassion in a way, because of all that it involves, approaching courage, oh, sorry, approaching suffering, being able to sort of stand strong and in the face of that suffering, to then do things actively to try to sort of alleviate that suffering. Your program was kind of ultimate courage. I know Russell Coltz has a compassionate approach to anger, and his program's called True Strength. So yes, there's
Oh,
sort
well,
of
there you go.
there's interesting, and thinking of the Coast Guard or police, or I've worked with a lot of military veterans. I mean, their jobs are actually compassionate jobs. To be hanging
Right.
from the helicopter, risking in a way oneself and drawing on lots of skills and so on to save someone, that is
Right.
compassionate. And so,
Right.
it is really just expanding that compassion to kind of include themselves in a way as well.
It's a bit of a conundrum, like we had a meeting of a whole bunch of MSC teach male MSC teachers about how do we get more men into the program. And at some point, we had a lot of good ideas. I don't know if any of them went anywhere, but we started to ask ourselves, well, what was it that drew us? And then we realized we were not the kind of people that we were trying to reach. But
No.
people like us come to these programs. I don't know what it is about us, but that's how we end up,
Yes.
how you and I have met and everything else.
Yes.
How do we expand the circle? How do we talk about this in a way that invites people in to considering something they never would have considered? It's an interesting thing, and I think it's our I actually think this has something to do with something you and I briefly chatted about before we started recording, which is we probably have to do a lot more groundwork to ease more people into this conversation, more men, more people in general, but in this case, men, to familiarize people. This is why like a weekend workshop was more appealing than a 5-day intensive. We need to find ways for people to begin to dip their toes in the water of these practices with some kind of support, but begin to see what would it be like to treat myself, to ask myself, what do I need in a moment, and to actually offer it to myself in small ways that maybe say, oh, well, that was interesting for me to actually notice. Oh, this is, the core practice of MSC is this self-compassion break, right? Just boiling it down to the three components of self-compassion: mindfulness, in a moment of suffering, just noticing that suffering is here. Like, oh, this hurts. This is painful. This is stressful. Common humanity. Well, this is how people feel when they're in this situation. This is a part of being human to feel this feeling that I'm feeling. And then the common humanity, or the, and then the self-kindness to say, what do I need? Given that this is a moment of suffering that every human has at one time or another, what do I need here? So small bites seems to me a way for people to say, wow, that was interesting. That moment was different than other moments of suffering because of the way I met it or the way I met myself. Maybe there's something to this. What else could I do? I think that's kind of on us to figure out ways of getting this to people in small doses that makes them want to pursue larger doses over time. So I don't
It's
have
it
answers, just questions.
Yes, it's very interesting on YouTube, for example, because I'll sometimes post a short or a video, and then overnight, often a man will comment and say, "This is all stupid," or words to that effect. Not necessarily always that polite, but by the time I've woken up, not uncommonly, another man will say, "Well, hang on a sec," and they'll make a little comment as well, and then in the morning I might sort of try to engage a little bit with the whole conversation too. So it's sort of, I think, there was a early on I used to feel a bit sort of taken aback by it, but now I think I really see it in the terms that you're saying, which is this gradual sort of just eking out this little kind of sense in the community of compassion and what it is, and perhaps seeing if we can kind of shift people just that little bit each time. Usually the person who's saying this is all stupid is someone who's suffering and who has had bad experiences with this in one way, shape, or form. And so, yeah,
Those are
it's a slippery.
beautiful. Those are beautiful opportunities when people show that kind of behavior to be met with compassion, whether from you or from one of these other people, right? Because
Yeah.
that's not what they get most of the time. It's a
That's right.
self-fulfilling thing. The more that you sort of dismiss this as a bunch of baloney or worse, the more, or the, you know, the more negative you are, the more negativity you tend to get back in the world. So it's sort of incumbent on us that teach this to do our best to respond to that pain with kindness, like demonstrating for people this is what compassion actually is. It's meeting your suffering with a will. I don't have to like it. It's not good behavior, but if I meet you with kindness and I can see the pain behind the bad behavior, that's really powerful stuff. I mean, that's the stuff of therapy, right? The goal is to for people to have a corrective experience, to sort of actually experience what is compassion actually like. Because if they're going around the world all prickly and nasty, they're not getting a lot of exposure to compassion. So those moments can be really kind of powerful.
Well, Steve, I really appreciate this fascinating conversation. You're right, there are lots of interesting questions about well, kind of disseminating self-compassion generally. I mean, mindful self-compassion has done an amazing job of that over the years, but there are little niches that we can still do some work on. Men, I guess, is one of the ones that is particularly interesting. What about do you what are your sort of current projects, or how can people perhaps find you or reach you if they want to engage with your work?
So I do have a modest website, drstephenhickman.com. I did write Self-Compassion for Dummies, which I'm quite proud of.
I was going to
that
mention that, Steve. I
okay
thank you very much. Self-compassion for dummies, yes.
yeah it's I had a lot of fun writing it. It's largely drawing from MSC, but I had fun because the for Dummies encourages you to have fun, so it's a little more lighthearted than the program, and it's accessible, and I tried to really write it with men in mind. I mean, it's not geared for men, but I tried to make room for the struggles that men might have with the material. So that's a great way to find that. And I've been doing a lot of sharing of self-compassion in bite-sized doses on this new platform called Threads that lives alongside Instagram. And I have some fun there. It's just, I'm not trying too much to be any sort of influence or anything else. I'm just dropping words of wisdom and guidance and ways of looking at things through a self-compassion lens there. So I'm basically retired. I'm consulting on a few projects here and there, doing a little bit of teacher training of mindful self-compassion, and mostly enjoying life as a retired person.
Right.
So,
Wonderful.
but I can't stop talking about these topics, which is why
Yes.
we're here. So there you
Thank you
go.
very much. Yes, I'll put links to those various things, your book included, but also your website and so on, and on the description, and but otherwise, yeah, thank you again very much for coming
Great.
and chatting with me.
It was awesome. It was good to hang out together.
Great.